Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest-growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Hey guys, welcome to Breaking Banks. We are live from New York today. I have a little bit of a croak in my throat today, so if I'm a little bit croaky, you'll understand why. But thanks for joining us. A lot to get through in the news today. Of course, Google I.O. event is on right now, so everyone's talking about Android Pay. What happened to Google Wallet? So they're going with a relaunch strategy around Android Pay. The only question, I guess, is we heard Ian Carr talking about the LoopPay acquisition a couple of weeks ago. So there's a bit of a question about what's going to happen with that whole Samsung thing with the Samsung Pay versus Android Pay. So we'll see how that pans out. Also in the news, did you guys see the Mary Meeker report, the Internet Trends report? It's always a staple. Everyone seems to get very excited about it, to pass it around around Twitter and so forth when Mary Meeker comes out. That some of the highlights that I took from this, definitely you can see the messaging platforms, and platforms generally are really huge. The top five internet companies around the world, all platform-based: Apple, Google, Alibaba, Facebook, Amazon. And then the big changes. Average American spends now 5.6 hours a day on the internet, and mobile is really set for a continued explosion, particularly just in terms of adoption. We're looking at about 3 billion people on mobile right now, but we're going to add more people to mobile and the internet over the next 5 years than we have since the internet was commercialized in mid-90s. So pretty exciting time. All of this leads to some pretty interesting changes in the way we work. And there's big data at the end of this showing that people's work habits, particularly millennials and Gen Z, their work habits are changing pretty dramatically, with them having supplementary work. Airbnb, Uber and other things like that were called out. But the old days of you have one job for life are definitely gone. Some really interesting data there. You should check it out. Some other research that came out during the week was the FMSI Teleline study. And we have W. Michael Scott, the CEO of FMSI, Financial Management Solutions, Inc., who's joined us to give us some highlights of that. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brett. It's a pleasure and an honor to be on your show today.
Yeah, it's great. So the Teleline study is something that you've run for a number of years. Tell us about the history of the Teleline study.
Well, we have a SaaS service for banks and credit unions in which we do their productivity analysis, forecasting of their traffic flow patterns, and generating upcoming schedules for every unique day of the week and following month. And then we've been doing a study on that from all of our client base since we host all the data since 1992. Every year we do a study in the month of March, and that month has very little on vacation time, so we figure that's a pretty stable month to take a look at.
So really interesting longitudinal analysis. Now, we go back just a few years ago, and we were looking at transactional activity being something around 11,500, 12,000 transactions per month in the average branch in the United States. But the latest data continues to see decline in transactional activity and branch activity generally. Can you give us some of the highlights in respect to the numbers?
Well, since 1992, the average branch has had a 45% decrease in volume to today. But there are a few variables involved in that. In 1970, there was a branch for every 9,300 people, and today there's a branch for every 3,600 people. So the number of branches went from 21,000 to 93,000, and so there are a lot more branches. The population has increased also, but on a per capita basis, there are more branches today servicing a smaller per capita per branch than there used to be. Interesting to me is that in the decades past, we had everything was checks, deposits. item processing. Today, everything is digital. Very little flow in the check collection process, but and much more technology than there were in decades past.
Yet so it's not just purely the fact that we're overbranched in terms of population, but it's also that a lot of the stuff that we used to do to branch in the branch has moved out of the branch.
That's correct. That's correct. And everyone used to pay their utility bills. And those would come in through the branches and deposits. Today, most of that's done through ACH drafts. So a lot of activity has changed. Mobile banking, internet banking.
And what is this? What has this done to the labor costs for the average? You know, you call this a Teleline study, but the average staff in the branch. What's happened to those costs recently?
In 1992, the average pay rate, including benefits, factored down to an hourly rate, was $8.85. Today, in 2015, it's $16.82. So it's a 90% increase in the pay, and the productivity has been flat to a small decline, even though there's been a great improvement in technology, in imaging. There is an opportunity that to right-size your staff with the declining volume. And sometimes management is a little bit behind the curve, therefore their costs increase. And labor cost per transaction has gone up 133% since 1992. Pay rates have gone up 90%.
Yeah, that's a pretty significant increase. What are you seeing? I mean, we keep seeing these announcements about branch closures. What can you tell us about the hard data behind that?
Well, I would say from our customer base, we still see some growth. There is some consolidation of low volume branches and markets that might not be served. But in the past two decades, there's been a lot of consolidation in the banking industry, and that has accounted for some of the branch closures. The others are by design in the employing more technology and their desire to have more consolidation through remote teller operations, through sophisticated walk-up ATMs. But all in all, I would say for our client base, there has not been a significant decline in closures.
And do you think that this trend is going to continue, speed up? You think that closures and branch modality is going to be challenged over the next 5 years?
I think it will be. I think there will be a change in the branch to more of a universal agent or associate doing multi-functions. And we may see in the medium to lower size volume branches, the teller line may be consolidated into pods. But for the heavier volume branches, I think we'll still see a dedicated line for the tellers and then a separate operation for the platform within the branch.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for joining us, Michael. The FMSI Teleline study, people can download that online?
Yes, at our website, fmsi.com, under our resource library.
Fantastic. Thanks for joining us today on Breaking Banks.
My pleasure.
Ian Carr and Dave Birch, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Brett.
Hey, Brett. How are you?
Good, good. Now, Ian, I know you've got an interview coming up, so we'll get to that in a moment. But, Dave, you know, some news came out during the week about ATMs. Did you want to share that with us?
Yeah. I mean, it was a kind of an interesting statistic, which is that the fraud on ATMs, so this is basically criminals using, you know, clever little bits of kit to steal the data from your card when you put it in an ATM. Card skimming, yeah. This is at its highest level for 20 years. In fact, as far as I can tell, at its highest level since there was a level to be measured. It's essentially out of control. And you know, broadly speaking, it's getting worse, of course, because as more and more places convert over to chip and PIN, as the data is stolen from the stripes, you have to find you know, if you steal the data off the Stripe, you've got to find somewhere that takes Stripes where you can use it. And that's, broadly speaking, the US.
Yeah,
so the UK, for example, all the ATMs have been chip and PIN for years, right? So I take my chip and PIN card and I stick it into an ATM that reads the chip. But because I have to stick it into a slot in the ATM, that's where the criminals attach the devices. So even though I've got a chip and PIN card and I'm putting it into a chip and PIN ATM, the criminals can still steal the data from the magnetic stripe. And then, of course, they use it to make a counterfeit card, which they use, you know, in the US. And so it's out of control.
So let me ask you then, because you said that it was out of control and you said the statistic was pretty incredible. You didn't mention the number, but what was the increase?
I'd have to go and look it up in the Wall Street Journal because I didn't write that bit down. But it's 174% in the first quarter. Debit compromises on ATMs located on bank property. Non-bank machines, it's over 300% the increase. Yeah. So this is, you know, people sneaking into clubs and little stores and fitting the counterfeiting devices. And I wanted to make, the reason why I think this is kind of interesting, given that we've all had chip cards for years, is that the problem is the slots, right? So you've got a fancy chip card, but as long as you've got to put it in a slot, that's where the criminals can attack it. And I was just thinking, there's a rather obvious way to attack this, right? Which is that stop putting the cards in slots. You know, my debit card has been contactless for, actually, I don't know how long it's been contactless for, like 4 years or something. None of the ATMs in the UK take contactless, right? So when I go to use my card, I still have to put it in a slot. I've had a fantastic mobile banking app on my phone for years. My bank has a great mobile banking app. I've often wondered why I can't just tell the mobile banking app, you know, just you know where I am, where the phone
NCR
is.
NCR and those guys have worked on prototypes.
The cashless, you know, there's plenty of people that have these systems, but a lot of banks don't implement it yet. And so what I was kind of thinking was maybe this statistic is so bad that it will actually trigger them into doing something about it. Well, and that will be a boost for the mobile app, right?
But the stats on Magstripe card fraud in the US are just out of control. And yet, you know, merchants not so motivated. We'll see what happens in October, right? With the
merchants don't bear the... they will do after the EMV liability shift. But right now, if I use a stolen or counterfeit UK Magstripe in a US merchant face-to-face, the merchant doesn't bear the cost of that. The cost goes back to the issuing bank. Uh-huh. Card-not-present fraud, it's different. Card-not-present is the merchant. So actually, the banks are taking the hit on this at the moment. But it just strikes me that maybe it's finally got so bad.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing, isn't it? A lot of people say, but what about mobile? Is it secure? And the reality is, if you want to reduce fraud and you want to improve security, then technology does that for you.
Well, this is why I'm baffled.
The weakest link is the old tech. The weakest link is the manual processes, the old systems.
Too right. And this is why it's so puzzling to me when you see these continuous surveys, like the thing that concerns consumers most about mobile payments, whatever, is security. And they're using things that are a million times less secure than a phone, like cash, for example, or Mac Stripes.
Well, we're on the same page there. For those of you listening to the show, you're not familiar with what EMV stands for. This is the chip credit and debit cards that the US is now introducing, finally, that have been in places like Europe for 10 years. The chip has the details encrypted on a chip, makes it much harder to compromise. But, of course, now with NFC or near-field communication, we can have this within the phone, and it's a tokenized form of identity, even more secure again. So, Dave, thanks for joining us on the show today. Sorry we don't have more time to chat because we love having you on the show.
You're always welcome, Brett.
Ian... Welcome
hey,
back.
Brett. How are you guys?
Tell us. Good. Yeah, got a bit of a croak today, but apart from that, I'm okay.
Yeah, this weather is killing me. I have a little bit of allergy as well.
Weather's great. It's like 29 degrees Celsius. I don't know what that is in Fahrenheit. What's the weather in Fahrenheit, Rachel, today? 100? Is it like that? 98 or something? It's very nice. So why didn't you come into the studio today, Ian?
You know, I'm in Jersey today, and it's a far trek. And if I was in the city, I would have definitely stopped by. Otherwise,
that's fine. Tell us about the interview you've got for us.
So yeah, I talked to Pat Filon, who's the CEO of TrustDev, an e-commerce fraud company. And we talk about really the EMV shift that's coming up in October and what retailers can really start to get prepared for and start to expect with the shift that's coming up, since retailers will be using terminals with that conduct EMV transactions. How is that going to impact the other ways we purchase items? For instance, Pat and I speak about e-commerce fraud going up.
Okay, so let's get into it. Let's see what he has to say. And Matt, can you roll the interview with Pat?
We're here with Pat Filon, CEO of TrustDev, an e-commerce fraud prevention company. And we're going to talk about the EMV transition that's coming up in October and the mobile payments industry. So, Pat, what's the impact of mobile anti-fraud technology like Apple Pay and EMV having on fraud?
Well, EMV arrival is really interesting, Ian. The last two major internet markets to get an EMV were Australia and Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, USA retail fraud has been so easy to commit. I can take someone else's card. I can walk into a store with a female card. Nobody's ever going to question any. And the stores are never going to question it because it's treated right now under card present. So that the risk returns to the accepting bank. So the merchants have been covered 100% up to now. With the arrival of chip and PIN, obviously the opportunity for fraud is completely eliminated.
Mm-hmm.
And the only time fraud will exist is where someone has got access to your PIN. It'll be very much like using a debit card or an ATM card in a transaction in store. So that completely eliminates retail fraud. Now, these fraudsters aren't going to get jobs. So what has happened in the last two major markets, as I said, which was Canada and Australia, was the year following the introduction of EMV in retail, online fraud doubled. So what you're going to see in the next 12 months, probably early next year, last quarter to all of 2016, is an explosion of e-commerce fraud.
Hmm.
And, you know, all our customers and everyone we're chatting with are now starting to prepare for the tsunami of fraud.
Right, since the retail fraud is essentially, you know, solved, the fraudsters turn to committing e-commerce fraud, which, in your opinion, do you think it's easier to carry out e-commerce fraud as opposed to retail fraud, or is it more difficult?
I think it's probably a bit more difficult because there is more information required with physical e-commerce products. There is the shipping, there is the billing. It does give the merchant a chance to hold the order or, you know, do 2 to 3 day delivery. But that option is now beginning to change because what had happened up to now was the merchant would hold a retail product and he would hold it for 2 or 3 days and possibly do manual review on any order he was worried about. But now with this instant gratification of Amazon and all the instant delivery firms.
The on-demand economy.
Exactly. So the customer has become used to, you know, same day shipping or at worst case, next day shipping.
Yeah, worst case is Amazon Prime's 2 day shipping. You know,
exactly.
Things are coming so fast now, it's hard to, you know, do the manual labor.
And, you know, even to all of us as consumers, we're so delighted with Amazon Prime next day shipping or 2 day at the very worst. That's now becoming the norm. So it's eliminating the opportunity for the customer to do manual review, especially if they're large merchants. And the other area, which is really interesting, where we work with a lot of customers, is in digital goods, where there is no time for any sort of review. It's an instant download of a digital good, be that mm-hmm. a park voucher, a gift card for iTunes. It's an enormous business in the US around gift cards.
Right.
So I think they're going to be the two areas where there's going to be significant problems next year.
Interesting. I feel like there are a lot of new technologies, especially when it comes to machine learning and a lot of these cloud services and stuff. that fraudsters could be using to carry out e-commerce attacks on retailers. Could you elaborate about, whether or not fraudsters are using new tech to commit fraud?
Yeah, there's certainly a number of devices. There are certainly a number of tools that enable fraudsters to hide certain pieces of their identity, as in, we're all aware of the proxy style tools. But then there are some more advanced tools where customers have been able to, or fraudsters have been able to try fake their whole identity. Mm-hmm. By, saying create a fake device ID, create a fake IP address, create a fake proxy. And what's happened there is, in reality, that's really caused problems with the manual review piece.
Right.
Because on the manual review piece, there is so much fake information then that it's becomes...
It's taking longer to check.
Exactly. Right? And yeah. It's so confusing that, manual review is a thing that should have been gone years ago.
Right.
A lot of companies...
It seems archaic. Or it's like...
Unbelievable. People making... It's wrong 27% of the time. Humans are biased. They can have a bad day with somebody. They're biased towards that race. They're biased towards this country. They're Nigeria. It's full of gangsters. Not shipping to Russia. It's all fraud, which couldn't be further from the truth.
Yeah.
The majority of humans in each country are honest. So we should try sell to the honest people and eliminate the fraud people using something like Trustiv because we can identify them.
Yeah. What kind of fraud trends can retailers expect? I think you mentioned e-commerce fraud went up in a lot of other countries when EMV is implemented. Is there anything else retailers in the U.S. can expect when it comes to fraud over the next year?
I think they can expect, number one, kind of a turning to zero of fraud in retail. And that's the experience worldwide. When there is a chip and pin, there is no fraud, unless there's collusion. So that'll go to absolute zero, which is very helpful. I think you can also see, people are saying, it's going to be difficult to remember four-digit numbers, which is absolutely silly. And we already remember four-digit numbers for our ATM card.
Yeah.
So I think you'll probably see potentially a little slowing up in the retail operations. If everybody's putting in a PIN in a queue, that's going to be a little bit slower. But I think the offset on that is these fraudsters will know the chip and PIN exists. It completely eliminates the skimming industry where your card can be skimmed because they don't have the PIN in retail. And I think I think what you're going to see is you're going to see a massive increase. I would think it's going to be exponential online, especially in the US.
Well, thanks, Pat.
No problem. Thanks, Ian.
It's been probably the best thing we've ever done, without a doubt.
In 2011, Duane Blomstrom and Maniga headed to the first Finovate in Europe.
We were a very small company back then, six people. We had decided that we're going to actually demo, which was a big step for a small company at that time.
After winning Best of Show, they grew to be a European market leader in personal financial management.
Pipeline essentially exploded as a result of this. It essentially put us on the map.
So why do they keep going back to Finovate?
It keeps us honest innovation-wise.
Register today for Finovate Spring 2015 in San Jose on May 12th and 13th and experience future fintech first.
When you're looking for the right place to eat, there's an app for that. When you need directions getting there, there's an app for that. And if you're trying to make a healthy choice, there's an app for that. But what about an app that tells you how you're doing with your money? Now, there's an app for that. It's called Moovin, a free app and debit account that automatically tracks your spending. You get real-time feedback with every purchase you make and a debit account with no overdraft or monthly fees. So if you want to stay on track with your money, download the Moovin app for free on iPhone or Android and check out Moovin.com. That's M-O-V-E-N.com.
So, banks have a nice little exchange rate going on between themselves, but another, bigger exchange rate for you when you want to send money home or overseas. And they'll throw in some bank charges too, just for good measure. Not really fair, is it? But what if you could set your own exchange rate? That would be currency fair. CurrencyFair.com is a unique peer-to-peer marketplace that means you get a better rate and get to bypass those bank charges. You can't say fairer than that. CurrencyFair.com, the smarter way to send money home or abroad.
The successful businesses of today do everything they can to meet the needs of their customers. But outdated IT systems mean that banks often struggle to offer the same level of personalized service. SunTech is working with some of the world's leading banks to help them provide the products, offers, and services that their customers need and want. Visit suntechgroup.com to find out more. That's suntechgroup.com.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag #BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
Hey guys, welcome back to Breaking Banks. I know that was a long segment, that first one. We had a lot to get through, but let's go straight into the second segment. My guest for the show today is Tom Gorenfeld. I'm sure you guys who read Forbes know Tom as a contributor there. He's a freelance writer specializing in the fintech space. He works a lot about Gen Z and the fintech players, but also this merger between sort of the major tech companies and the banks who are looking at fintech and innovation. And Tom, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Thank you.
So I did notice that you were involved in this Nextbank Europe thing, and there was an interesting discussion I want to just jump straight into, which was really about customer experience and the banking experience, and this key question: do we really want to have a relationship with our bank?
You know, I get a ton of surveys. I think Accenture's done one, Deloitte's done one, Capgemini. And I think that they have a bias in them because they ask people what they want from their banks instead of saying, what institutions do you really like? In which case, banks might never get mentioned. So people came back with saying, well, I'd like to get rewarded for loyalty, or I'd like financial advice. And I'm not sure that that's really accurate, because if they just ask people, where would you go for financial advice, they might never mention banks.
Yeah.
So I think banks may be in more trouble than they think.
Yeah, well, I'm with you, of course, but that wouldn't be a surprise for you to see that. So, you know, in terms of the whole experience thing, we obviously see a huge amount of investment going into fintech right now. You know, what is your feel for who's going to end up with that key connection to the customer?
Well, I'll tell you, I looked at one of these surveys that said Accenture asked, who would you trust most with your personal information? And 86% said banks. But in fact, banks only know a bit about us. Facebook knows more. Amazon knows more. Apple iTunes. Yep. We trust them with our financial information. We also give them tons of other information. So I did my own not-so-scientific study last night. I asked my wife what she thinks of banks, and she said, I hate banks.
Yeah.
If I could do finance through Amazon, I'd do it right away.
I don't think your wife is unique in feeling that way.
Yeah, and I don't think a lot of emphasis on digital channels and frills on banking get past the core issue. You know, why does it cost me $12 a month to have a bank account? I don't know.
So this is really interesting. You know, do we have a relationship with a bank? With, you know, we talk about this. Bankers talk about this a lot, about the relationship they have with their customers, brand trust. But really, in the last few years, bankers become more about utility than it has trust. You know, I think 30 years ago, it was about trust, that, you know, you're going to put your money somewhere. But these days, the utility is sort of that, almost that replacement for trust. Is that right to say that, do you think, Tom?
Well, I certainly don't think very much about the banks that I deal with. You know, I go in, because I'm a freelancer, I get checks, I get paid the old-fashioned way. So I know the people in my bank branch, but it doesn't really mean I have a relationship with the bank.
So, you know, if you're talking with people like Temenos and these other players that are trying to digitize the experience, or if you're looking at this, you know, what's your commentary as an industry observer saying where this is going to pan out?
Well, I like a digital experience because it means I don't have much. It's faster and easier. but I don't see very many banks doing what Movin and Simple are doing, which is putting themselves squarely on the side of the consumer.
Yeah. Wow.
I think you've got a real edge there. And I'm not sure they're going to.
Yeah. I think it's more the bank psychology here, right? Banks are trying to, they're thinking about products and channels and customer segments. And I think it's really hard to step back from that and just say, what are people doing every day where they need our help as a bank to fix a problem, right? Rather than how do we sell this product or deliver this service over this channel to this customer? I think that's
I don't know about you, but how many times a month do you need a bank? I mean, besides just doing transactions.
Wow. Yeah. How many times a year?
Yes. How many times a year? I mean, you might do it with an investment firm, a Vanguard or Fidelity or Schwab, but a bank, what are they going to do?
So, this competency that you see emerging, you do a lot of talk, you represent the industry as sort of a discussion piece when you're writing about this in Forbes. You just wrote an article, yesterday on Finacle, their new banking software in the cloud and so forth. And then on the 16th, you talk about Gen Z banking with a new app that's coming out there. What's your feel in terms of the momentum that's building around this? Who's sort of emerging from the pack here, whether it's in banking or whether it's in the technology platform or for the fintech pure plays?
Well, I think not to play into your hands too much here, Brett, but I think
I'm not trying to get you to
I think Movin and Simple are really unusual in being allied with consumers, and maybe a few banks like Umpqua Bank out in Portland, which does a lot for consumers. I don't know what Tesco's done, but I would think they'd have an advantage because they can combine banking with awards through the supermarket, their main business. But for a bank, what do they have to offer? They can give me a slightly lower cost on a loan, or slightly more on a deposit. But all they have is money.
Are you bullish on the whole wearables thing?
I'm not sure it matters all that much.
It's kind of
cute, nice to have. But as far as the banking experience, does it make a difference? I don't know. I don't think much compared to a mobile phone.
Yeah. Well, it's got more. The phone's obviously got a lot more interactive, capability. It's a lot more personal. But is this sort of the split between notifications and messaging and apps that you use? I think that's where these platforms are going. Wearables aren't going to be try to be this smartphone on your wrist. This different sort of feel in terms of the prioritization of information and things like that. What about in the cloud space? What do you think? What impact do you think that those analytics piece and the cloud is going to have to the way we think about this, the banking ecosystem as a whole?
Yeah, and I was talking to the CEO of Tresato, which is a big data company. He said, it's just crazy. Some of these banks, when they merge, they just throw away the customer data from the companies that they acquire, and they don't have any idea how to use it. So analytics will be a step forward. But I'm not sure what you have to do with it. My wife said, I've got a car loan with U.S. Bank. Every time I make a payment, I have to enter my bank account number and my routing number. I said, how stupid is that?
Yeah. Well, I agree with that.
Yeah.
Well, they just announced this ACH expedited payment services. Did you see that, the Natura announcement?
No.
So 19th of May, we've had this debate about, faster real-time payments in the U.S. and now going to get down to two-day settlement. But it's like, well, hang on, Venmo's real-time. So here we go. We've got this great announcement that's taken 5 years or something like that to get some traction. And it's like, okay, we're down to 2 days now. So
yeah, but MasterCard just came out with instant payments to pretty much anybody.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the debit card to debit card. I didn't know. Did you see the Dilbert comic strip on acquisition this week?
No.
Did you guys see this? It says I'm just trying to find it now because it was so good. I can't remember what the boss's name is, the manager, the CEO, and basically comes in, introduces this new guy they just acquired. And he says, we just acquired his company. And then the next thing is, Dilbert, can you take him through the 45 hours of mandatory employee video training? And the guy says, I'm quitting. I just quit. And so Dilbert's like, well, at least we get his five customers with the that he had. But part of this challenge might be, you know, like BBVA seems to be a little bit different in the mentality. You've reported them quite a bit.
Yeah.
You know, you talk about their simple acquisition. You talked about their Gen Z thing. But their CEO is very focused on making BBVA a technology company. And do you think that that is going to differentiate them in the long term because of that DNA? They want to be a tech company, no longer a bank?
Yeah, he did a piece, an op-ed piece in the Financial Times a couple of months ago saying that if banks don't think they should be worried about Amazon, they're, you know, facing obsolescence pretty quickly. And I got stuck in my mind, John Schlesinger, who's the chief architect at Temenos, said to me a year and a half ago, he said, you know, banks can evaporate. If they don't get their costs under control, they could disappear. And people talking about banking often refer to the Kodak experience. You know, big, strong company and just gone in a couple of years. So I think that there's some real possibilities, real threats out there.
Did you hear the Peter Diamandis interview we had on a couple of weeks ago?
No, I didn't.
So now Peter, as you know, founder of the XPRIZE and also one of the founders of Singularity University. Just a quick plug, Exponential Finance next week with Peter and myself speaking in New York. But Peter, he said that at the height of Kodak's at worth, when they were worth more than $1 billion, they had 250,000 employees. No, sorry, 140,000 employees, and had invented the digital camera, but didn't think it was going to be disruptive to their business because they're talking about very, very small increments in terms of resolution capability. And then when Instagram was acquired for $1 billion, they had 14 employees. So showing really the difference in dynamics of efficiency of a technology company versus an incumbent pure play that's been in the business a long time.
How do you think that translates to banks?
Well, you know, this is the thing, is that, for Moovin, we've got, 115,000 customers or so right now on the platform. We've got 38 employees, but we're also supporting rollouts in six different countries right now. I mean, you know, which bank could do that for the scale that we've got in terms of efficiency? You know,
it's at some point that means that you can offer much better services at lower costs, right?
Yeah. Well, our cost of acquisition is down now to like $7 an install for the app. So you know what the cost of acquiring a checking account is. I mean, at some point, it's got to be purely about economics, doesn't it? Don't forget the relationship with the bank and experience. It's purely about how efficiently you can run this business. Let me ask you this way: if you're a bank today, what would you be most worried about? If you're a CEO of a bank, what would you be most worried about, and what would you be doing about it?
Well, I think I'd be looking at the making sure that digital works as well as it possibly can, and having that channel working. I was talking with a company, Blue Shore Bank, out in Vancouver, and they've turned into sort of a boutique bank and aimed at higher net worth, including self-employed people whose financial statements are often wouldn't qualify them for a loan because they tuck a lot of money away in various different ways. And they have things like scotch tasting at their branches. They're called branch spas. So they've gone to the high touch approach. I think high touch or nearly no touch, I think anybody in between is going to be struggling.
Yeah, that makes sense. So we've got about a minute before we go to break, Tom. So what are you looking at riding on at the moment that we should be watching out for?
Well, I'm going to be doing some things on cloud and some work on analytics in the next week or two, and trying to see, once you have the analytics, once you get that fabled 360-degree view of the customer, what do you do with it? Yeah. I think that's going to be a key. Or are you going to be throwing a lot of money into analytics that you're not getting any return from?
Yep, fair enough. Well, thanks for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks today. How do we keep up with your musings in Forbes?
I'm at forbes.com/sites/Tom Groenfeld.
Okay, or just do a search on Tom Groenfeld on Forbes on Google. Thanks for joining us, Tom.
Thank you.
So, guys, we're just going to take a quick break, and then after the break, we'll be back with an interview from Liz Lumley, our correspondent in the UK, talking to Deanna Oppenheimer, the former CEO of Barclays Bank. We'll be right back after this break.
Time. There's never enough. You just don't have the time to search out all the latest banking innovations from around the world. But the good news is, we've already done it for you at Banking Reports. 700 hours of research goes into each edition of our Global Banking Innovation Monitor. Be smarter and get one step ahead. Get Banking Reports sent quarterly to your inbox. To subscribe, follow us on Twitter at banking_reports.
The successful businesses of today do everything they can to meet the needs of their customers. But outdated IT systems mean that banks often struggle to offer the same level of personalized service. SunTech is working with some of the world's leading banks to help them provide the products, offers, and services that their customers need and want. Visit suntechgroup.com to find out more. That's suntechgroup.com.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here, and it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Moovin is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase, and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Moovin today.
Listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag #BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
Hey guys, thanks for joining us again on Breaking Banks. If you want to participate in the conversation, the hashtag is Breaking Banks. Right now, I want to cross to Liz Lumley. She's our global fintech ambassador. Also, those of you that know, she was at FinExtra. She's just joined Startup Bootcamp, Fintech Startup Bootcamp. Some of you guys know the co-founder there, Nick Eliolius, out of the UK. We should have Nick on the show, actually, Rachel, so keep that in mind. But Liz interviewed Deanna Oppenheimer, the previous CEO of Barclays Bank, who has now doing work in fintech. So let's hear from Liz Lumley and Deanna Oppenheimer.
Hello, how are you, Liz?
Very good. So now my first question, I usually ask people to explain their company and what it does, but I'm very awestruck. I'm speaking to Deanna Oppenheimer, so I feel a bit like the queen asking you this. You know, what is it that you do?
Well, that is this introduction, and I have to say I seem to be pivoting quite a bit as I go along, but in a nutshell, I connect up the innovation, particularly of the West Coast of the U.S., with global corporations and entities. So I sit on some global boards of very big entities, AXA Insurance, Tesco, Tesco Bank, NCR, all global businesses in technology, retailing, and financial services. But then I advise about a dozen or so CEOs, mostly in fintech, some outside that space, and mostly in their earlier parts of their career. You know, they're around 30, 35 years of age, getting into that place where they're growing their business into that global space. So it's really exciting. I see a breadth of things across the piece.
I think it's kind of interesting that you're doing a lot of this, especially sort of parts of it in financial services from the West Coast of the U.S., as opposed to sort of the East Coast and New York area, like sort of what might be considered a fintech hub.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the nice thing about being in Seattle is, one, as you can imagine, with Amazon here, Starbucks in the payment space, a number of other established players, is just a plethora of emerging technologies, emerging players here. And then it's only less than an hour flight down to Silicon Valley. So the West Coast, plus it's a pretty darn nice place to live, I must say that. It's also very, very accessible to Europe because you just hop on a nonstop plane and fly over the pole. So it's shorter than a lot of people believe, and I've done it for a number of years.
Cool. So, I mean, so you've long been a proponent of what a lot of people call customer-centric strategies, which a lot of banks have been telling me that they are now focused on the customer. But what I want to know, you know, what exactly does that mean from a banking perspective? You know, what are the practical considerations that banks have to do to really be customer-centric?
Well, historically, when I was an executive leading a number of different retail bank initiatives and different retail banks, I always defined it as it was a change or action or a decision that you took that you wouldn't have otherwise done, and you did it solely on the basis of customer insight. And a lot of times that might have meant it didn't look like it penciled out financially initially. It was taking a flyer on the customer, so to speak. And when we were creating customer-driven, customer-centric offerings, starting here with the bank I was with in Seattle, it was really a common thing to do because we didn't have other banks to look at. We were looking at customer service from the Nordstrom perspective. We were looking at branch distribution models from the Starbucks perspective.
So it's almost like you didn't have any bad habits to follow.
We certainly didn't have any banking habits to look at. And we had some leaders in other industries that were right here in town that we emulated a lot of their practices. Today, though, I think it's really interesting because the customer today, because of technology, because of all the things that you know so well, and of the whole literally emerging as we watch it, fintech space, customers really can drive the most important decision in banking, and that is, will I stay or will I go? You know, in the old days, I had a village or a town or a neighborhood, and there were one or two banking options, and that's pretty much the only way I could bank was through a branch banking experience. I didn't have real portable credit cards and payment options. I kind of had one way or the highway. It was a very different experience. But today, customer centricity, customer driven, whatever you want to call it, is they really are in charge. They're in charge because they can keep their business there. They can take parts of their business, parts of their revenues, and they can port it literally at one or two clicks. And that's why it is so absolutely essential today. It's not a nice to have, it's a must have, because they'll be with you or they won't at their discretion.
So yeah, I wanted to move on a little bit to talk about what a lot of people are calling challenger banks. I mean, you were head of the Barclays Retail Bank in the UK and you left in 2011. And sort of since then, we've seen this explosion of fintech and new alternative players and what a lot of people in the UK are calling challenger banks. You know, what is your take on this movement on alternative finance and sort of non-bank banks?
Yeah, well, first off, coming from a country where there were over 8,000 or 9,000 banks when I started, and today in the U.S., there still are over 7,000 banks and credit unions. You know, the fact that you had a few more challenger banks in is, I think, makes up for actually a more healthy, broad-based industry. And I would have said that when I was at Barclays. The more consumer options are, the better banks get, the more opportunities there are for careers in banking, and it just makes for a better ecosystem and a better environment. Today, I think what's happening, though, is that there's two things that are going on in addition to that customer bit. One is capital markets are seeing an opportunity to actually deploy capital in the UK. And that talks to the vibrancy of the market. There are people that are anxious to be deploying capital. And the second thing that's happened is the regulators in this space, you know, there's a lot been said in banking about the negative side of regulation in terms of intrusive regulation. In the challenger bank side, they've been very proactive on trying to encourage more banking coming into that market. So I think those two things, where you have a regulatory environment that's conducive and you have capital that's willing to come in, is making for a very fertile space in that challenger movement. It's got nurturing roots now that are going to let it take hold and keep developing, I believe.
Yeah, it's a strange thing to think that the regulators could be sort of nurturing some of that competition and innovation. It's an interesting thing to think about.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about yourself. What is your background?
Well, I am from a very small town in the northwest of the United States called Parma, Idaho. I had to drive to a town 14 miles away to learn how to stop at a stoplight. So that gives you a sense of how small that was. So I grew up in an environment where there were no limitations to what you could do, because so many people wanted you to be involved in whatever was going on, because there was never enough people to do everything. So that was a good thing. Went to a liberal arts university called the University of Puget Sound in Tacoma, Washington. I started then my very early period, right after, about 3 years after university, at a bank, Washington Mutual Bank, in Seattle, Washington. And at that time, we had 53 branches and less than $2 billion in assets. And through a series of massive acquisitions and growth, we grew that to about $350 billion and over 2,000 branches by the time I left about 20 years later. So that's the background. I was recruited then to come in to do the Barclays turnaround, and that's what got me into the UK.
So it's interesting that you mentioned you had a liberal arts degree, you know, but what attracted you to the financial services industry then?
I worked for a little bit in Washington, D.C. in a first job out of university, and then had moved back to Seattle. Banking in the United States was going through deregulation. It had been a very regulated industry. It was going through deregulation on price and other things. And I had also had a sales and marketing background. So I was looking for something that was challenging a regulated industry that was going through deregulation, that could use those two components of what my background had been. So I was looking for the challenges in banking. And I have to say today, they're still there. So it continues to be a really interesting space.
Yeah, so there's always excitement in banking. So I wanted a little bit, I mean, what are you passionate about that isn't financial services and financial technology related?
Yeah, you can kind of tell from the time I talked about my background. Family is a real important thing. I think they keep you humble. I think they keep you engaged. And I think they're a lot of fun. And it's a wonderful, wonderful legacy to see your children growing up and in careers of their own. So that would be a top passion for me.
How many children do you have?
I've got two grown adult children. One is working in Washington, D.C. in the nonprofit sector, and the other one is actually in banking in Chicago. So it's fun on that side. And then the arts, love music, love theater. I will say from my days at Barclays with the Premier League football, I became an Arsenal fan. So I'm very pleased to see them hopefully going to be securing that second bit. And then I'm an avid, always have been for since my youth, but continue to be an avid water skier.
So what do you think has been your biggest challenge in your career?
My biggest challenge is, I think, you know, there isn't any one big setback. I'm touching wood and really pleased to say I had a lot of opportunities, a lot of people that believed in me and gave me a lot of chances. I had one of those opportunities that have been good on that front. My challenges have been in my own making, and it's always around timing. You know, the core decisions have worked pretty well for me, but when they are spot on, the timing is absolutely right. I just knew it was the right time when I left Washington Mutual. I left after 20 years. It was a good time to leave based on what I needed to be doing and the evolution of that company. And that opened up my opportunity to come to Barclays and to come to the UK, which was a fabulous experience. So that timing was right. A lot of times on timing, it's when I have decisions that I know I should be making. Usually, a lot of times in the people decisions are those tough decisions you have to make. And I worry and I ponder and I wait and I wait. And then the timing is off, and that never is good. So I have to say my challenges are, one, of my own doing, and two, it's always around that sense of when you know you need to do it, you should act.
Excellent. I think that's kind of interesting what you're talking about. So I'll give you a quick one then. So what are you most proud of in your career?
I have to say the thing that I'm most proud of is the people that I've got to work with and to watch them now and see what they're doing in business and the things we accomplished when we were there. Whether it was at Washington Mutual with the growth that we were doing and the innovation that we had, whether it was the turnaround of the business in the UK for Barclays and setting the basis for them to be able to innovate off of that, all of that had to do with ordinary people coming together to do extraordinary things. And to get to lead teams to do that was a privilege indeed. And now it's fun to be working with other CEOs across a wide breadth of experience and geographic reach, as well as different industries, and see them get to develop some of those leadership skills as well and get to have a hand in helping them do that.
Excellent. So I've been giving this final question to every single interviewee, and it's if you were to meet a young or an older entrepreneur that has a brand new startup, what advice would you give them?
Well, the great thing is I get to meet a lot of them, and I say a couple of things to them. The first thing is it's all about the people and knowing how to always bring in people that are better than you at things that you are not so great at doing is something about knowing a lot about yourself and being vulnerable to recognizing your weaknesses and then shoring that up. So that's the first thing. It's all about the talent. Second piece of advice I would give them is the funding is as much art as science. And you better really understand how to do the funding, because that's been the biggest surprise to me coming from public market companies, working with startups, is at what point in time do you raise money? What point do you go out beyond family and friends? What point are you going to really look at dilution and all those types of things in it? Everybody comes into a startup with a great idea for a product or service, and too few of them focus on that aspect of it, because it's only as good as somebody's going to fund you at the point in time that you need to be looking at those options. So that's my second word of advice. And my third word of advice is to stay balanced. It's really tricky to do early on, and particularly for a young entrepreneur, they have all those pressures that we all remember, which is when you're trying to get your company up and running, you're trying to get your personal life up and running. A lot of times you have new relationships, sometimes families that you're starting, aging parents, all those types of things. So it's really important to do whatever small thing you can to stay balanced and to stay humble. Because I had a great mentor, and I'll probably end on this little word of advice that he gave me, a guy by the name of Lou Pepper, that remains as one of my key mentors today. He said that it's not that they want Lou Pepper, they want the CEO of this business. And so when you get too confused and think that it's really all about you, you've really missed it, because it's all about your privilege to get to lead that company. So never, never, never forget to keep that humility very close at hand.
Excellent. Excellent advice, Deanna. Thank you. Thank you very much for being on our series. And Brett, I'm going to hand it back to you.
Thanks, Liz.
Thanks, Liz. Thanks, Deanna Oppenheimer, for that interview. You can check out Deanna's cameo works on the web. And thanks also to Jumio, who is our sponsor for our major show sponsor. Keeping up a couple of dates, Inner Tribe at Sidebus is having their Singapore showcase today out in Singapore. Follow up with that on innertribe.com. And I know Finovate Spring just ended, but Finovate Fall, September, New York City, and Next Bank USA, June 17 and 18th. You use the code BREAKINGBANKS to save 30% off the fee. That's another wrap for Breaking Banks this week. Stay with us for next week. We've got more goodness coming, or check out BreakingBanks.com for episodes you've missed. I'm your host, Brett King. I'll see you guys again next week.
Been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.